All right, thank you so much. My name is Nick Schwartzall. I'm the line producer for BAM. And welcome to tonight's Radio Love Fest event. Radio Love Fest is a co-production of BAM and WNYC, listener-supported public radio. Here we are. And before we get started, I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, I'd like to thank my colleague and tonight's co-producer, Aaron Lewis, who's sitting over here. I just want to acknowledge that we have a couple of replacements tonight. We're super happy about this panel. Many of you may know that Ayaan Hersia Lee was originally going to take part, and then she withdrew for reasons of her own. And also, Razia Iqbal was going to be our moderator, and unfortunately, she fell at her home in London and hurt her knee and couldn't travel. Bummer. But what that meant was we have a really great host this evening, and I'm going to say a couple things about him before I bring him out here. So as you probably know, he's the host of the Brian Lehrer Show. So that gives away who it is, which airs weekdays from 10 to noon on WNYC. And I think it's particularly appropriate to tell you all that the show won a Peabody Award in 2007, specifically for producing radio that builds community rather than divides. And with that, it's my great pleasure to introduce Brian Lehrer, the moderator of tonight's discussion.
Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. Thank you very much for coming. You know, I'm maybe the wrong background to do this, so one of the wise guy panelists told me backstage, oh, you can play the role of the white friend. Now, this event was, of course, planned long before the attack and the Pamela Geller so-called Muhammad cartoon contest in Texas last week, but that event represents the intersection of two problems in the world right now: violent extremism in the name of Islam, at least, whether it's Islam or not, on the one hand, Islamophobia on the other. Remember, for example, that Pamela Geller's group has been labeled a hate group by the Anti-Defamation League, even though she says she stands for Defense of Israel. So if we begin tonight with the premise that no one here wants terrorism, and no one here wants bigotry, let's have a dialogue about how we can fight the one without enabling the other. I expect that our panel will divide roughly 3 and 3 on what they think the state of Islamophobia is. In some cases, I think they're going to be funny, and we're also going to somehow, in the midst of all this seriousness, have a little fun tonight. And we'll hear even in some cases what they think about the word Islamophobia, but we also expect we'll hear nuanced, thoughtful views, and who knows, maybe by the end some common ground. The format will be that each panelist speaks for about 3 minutes, and then I will moderate a conversation among them for a while, and then we'll take questions and comments from the audience. When we get to that point, we ask each speaker to keep your remarks or questions to 1 minute, to give many people their say, and to respect your fellow audience members in that way. We'll have two ushers with microphones. I realize, of course, that this is a very emotional topic for many people because it affects so many people very personally, but we ask that you keep your remarks or questions short nonetheless. First, just to get a little sense of who's here tonight, so you all know who's with you in the audience. How many of you live in Brooklyn? Hands, okay. How many of you live in Manhattan? Reverse commuters. Who thinks you came the furthest distance to this event? Who might have come the furthest distance? Hands? Shout it out. From where?
Stanford?
That's...
Egypt!
Bassem wins! Are you sure he went? No Indonesia? No Bangladesh?
No. Egypt wins.
Now that's far, Staten Island. How many of you come, just raise your hands, how many of you come thinking Islamophobia is a serious problem today? All right. So, interesting mix, and we have an interesting mix on the panel. Let me introduce everybody, and I'll go alphabetically. Wajahat Ali is the co-host of The Stream, a daily news show on Al Jazeera America. He is the lead author and researcher of Fear, Inc., Roots of the Islamophobia Network in America. This report from the Center for American Progress identifies a network of foundations and individuals who are bankrolling Islamophobia in U.S. politics. He is a lawyer, a consultant to the U.S. State Department, and a playwright. Douglas Murray is an author and journalist based in London. He is the associate director of the Henry Jackson Society, a British think tank, and associate editor of The Spectator magazine. He writes regularly for The Spectator, as well as The Wall Street Journal and The Daily Mail, covering a range of subjects, including literary biography, counterterrorism, and most recently, what he calls Islamophilia, which is also the title of his most recent book. Faisal Saeed Al-Muttar is an Iraqi-born writer and human rights activist. He was admitted to the U.S. in 2013 as a refugee after losing his brother and cousin in sectarian warfare. He is the founder of the Global Secular Humanist Movement, one of the largest online secular platforms in the world. He is a columnist for Free Inquiry magazine, where he advocates for secular values, science, reason, and the free market of ideas. Asra Nomani was born in Bombay and grew up in West Virginia. She traveled to Pakistan to report for the Wall Street Journal in the wake of 9/11. Her colleague and friend Daniel Pearl was kidnapped while staying at her Karachi home. She wrote Standing Alone, an American woman's struggle for the soul of Islam, which challenges intolerant, violent, and sexist interpretations of Islam. In January of this year, she also wrote a widely circulated essay for the Washington Post in which she argued that public accusations of Islamophobia are having a chilling effect on critical debate. Linda Sarsour is the Brooklyn-born executive director of the Arab American Association of New York, where she focuses on community development, youth empowerment, and immigrants' rights. She conducts trainings on civic engagement for the National Network for Arab American Communities, a network of Arab American organizations in 11 states and Washington, D.C. And Bassem Youssef was the host of Al Bernameg, the first televised political satire show in the Middle East and the most watched show in the history of Egyptian TV. You may. Did you bring your, like, whole family here?
They're paid.
Apologies to those who actually paid for your tickets. Over 3 years, the show grew in prominence. The show grew in prominence for bold criticism of the ruling Morsi and Mansour regimes and the Muslim Brotherhood. Youssef has also been accused of insulting Islam, the armed forces, and disrupting public order and peace. He is a cardiothoracic surgeon by training and is a Spring Fellow at the Kennedy School of Government in Harvard. Please welcome our entire panel. And so we'll start by going 3 minutes apiece on the question, roughly, how big a problem is Islamophobia today, and what should we do about it? Linda Sarsour will speak first.
I had a slice of humble pie before I got here, but Dr. Bassem forgot to have his. I'm very honored to be the only one up here representing Brooklyn. I want to start by saying that I am unapologetically Muslim. I am a very proud Palestinian, and I'm very proud to be born and raised in Brooklyn, New York. For folks who don't even know what Islamophobia is, it's very simple. It's anti-Muslim sentiment. It's a term for prejudice against, hatred towards Islam or Muslims. And I want to set the stage to let you know that Islamophobia is real. And Islamophobia is not just people who disagree with Islam or people who, don't agree with some tenets of Islam. That's you're free to do that. I'm cool with that. What I'm not cool with is the consequences that come with Islamophobia. And as someone who lives and works in a Muslim community, who travels across the country, I will tell you that the consequences of Islamophobia are real. They are manifested in the media. We have young people who are being bullied in the school system. We have anti-Sharia legislations, which are basically pieces of legislation in over 24 states, which would limit the opportunity for Muslims to practice their faith fully. Islamophobia is could be manifested in the most extreme ways, including hate crimes and bias incidents against Muslim Americans and Muslims, and those, unfortunately, who are perceived to be Muslim, most often people from the Sikh community. Mosque opposition. Look, 9/11 happened 14 years ago. I never heard after 9/11, even months after 9/11, did I ever hear of people protesting the building of mosques. And we have seen just in the past 4 to 5 years mosque oppositions across the country. I've traveled to many states where I would sit in zoning board meetings for people fighting for the right to build a religious institution. In the United States of America, we understand that people came here for their right to practice their faith. So what we have to understand about Islamophobia is that it has consequences, and on the receiving end is the Muslim community. That's number one. Number two, Islamophobia is an industry in this country. People are making millions of bucks on dehumanizing and vilifying Muslims. And we understand that from many research that that Wajahat will talk about, that other organizations have done, that people are bankrolling on dehumanizing our community. And what I want people to understand is that we have a generation that's coming up in this country of American Muslims who are just like me, who are proud to be American, but also darn proud to be Muslims. And I'm very proud of the faith that I follow. And while I welcome critical thought and conversation about Islam, I will not accept the vilification and dehumanization of my community or the faith that we follow. Thank you.
Douglas Murray.
Well, thank you. Let me start by saying this may be a bit semantic, but let me just make the following point. My problem with the term Islamophobia to start with, and I'll get on to some other things in a moment. The problem with the term Islamophobia, as all of you know from your dictionaries, is that a phobia is an irrational fear. Arachnophobia, claustrophobia, small spaces don't tend to kill you. It's an irrational thing to be fearful of. Now, the cartoonists and editors at the left-wing anti-racist French satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo have been called Islamophobes since their murder, and they were called Islamophobes before their murder. I just put it out there. Do you really think this is an appropriate term when we have to consider, was it irrational? If they were phobes, was it irrational of them to have this fear? Or might it not have turned out to have been fairly rational to have had a fear of at least some elements of Islam? Secondly, I have to make this point. One of the, it's a glaring absence tonight. My friend Ayan Hassiali is meant to be here and isn't. She isn't indisposed. She hasn't got, you know, she didn't sleep in or something. She was advised not to be here tonight for security reasons. And I think that needs to be mentioned because that's the reality of the world we now live in. Now, another problem with the word Islamophobia is that it is currently used, I would say. Linda doesn't use it like this. As I said, she's fine with criticism of Islam as a faith, but a lot of people are not. A lot of Muslims are not. And Islamophobia is very widely used now against, for instance, even people carrying out historical criticism about Islam, even people who are saying things about the sources of Islam, asserting their right to do that as they have the right to do about any and all other faiths. Now, if we were to use a word in this area, I would agree we could use the word anti-Muslim. We could use the term anti-Muslim. Is there such a thing as anti-Muslim hatred? That is something that is worth discussing. It's also worth discussing, and bearing in mind for a moment, where that might come from. Because that, as well, is, and I'll get on to this in a second, but that is, again, something that doesn't come from nowhere. If there are people who dislike Muslims, there are people who will dislike all Muslims and who have to be criticized and we have to critique and we have to stop them from generalizing. But they don't get some of their ideas from nowhere. They get it because they look at the news every day and they see the bombings and they see the beheadings and they see the anti-Semitism and they see the persecution of Christians and they see the persecution of minorities within Muslim faiths and they see all of these things and they are worried about them. And that does not come from nowhere. It isn't a sort of a brain seizure they've got about it. You know, people say, well, people wouldn't say this about any other group. I put it out there as a thought experiment. If any other group across the world were, quite often, and with significant, and indeed sometimes total clerical support, carrying out the most barbarous acts, you would criticize that community wherever they were, whoever they were. Finally, let me get onto this point. if that thing that I mentioned, anti-Muslim hatred, does exist, let's also consider that it may be a secondary problem. It is not the Islamophobia, anti-Muslim, whatever you want to use, may be a secondary problem. It comes from the extreme Islam that people see around the world, and they see happening in cities in the West now as well. They see that, and they're worried about it. And if they are worried about it, and this is something we should take on board, then that is a secondary problem. But you cannot deal with that without dealing with the primary problem, which is to deal with Islamic fundamentalism worldwide. Deal with that, and every other problem from this will melt away.
Thank you. Wajahat Ali.
Assalamu alaikum. May peace be with you. Good evening, Brooklyn. Thank you for joining us for this heartwarming conversation on Islamophobia. It should be a real love fest. That was for the hashtag. I demand extra money for that. I am Wajahat Ali, a multi-hyphenated, left-handed, consistently brown-skinned son of Pakistani immigrants, born and raised in the Bay Area, California, whose first language was Urdu and spoke only three words of English when I was dropped at Child's Hideaway Preschool. Word number one, shut up. Word number two, idiot. My mother used to say, shut up, idiot. And word number three, uh-oh, pasgerio. I am, it's true, that's really, because it was uh-oh, spaghettio for those of you who are old, and I was a fob who said, uh-oh, pasgerio. I am an American Muslim of Pakistani descent, and nothing says popularity in 2015 like American Muslim of Pakistani descent. Thank you. We are so popular, winning. In America, they ask me, why does Islam hate the West? Abroad, I'm asked, why does the West hate Islam? And as a Muslim, I'm asked all the time to apologize for criminal actions that I've never done by violent extremists that I've never met. And all this time that I'm asking myself, who is Islam and who is the West, and how come I've never met either of them? See, Islam doesn't speak. Muslims do. And the overwhelming majority of Muslims, according to facts, studies, and polls, reject violent extremism, love our freedoms, and are quote-unquote moderate. You must have heard of the moderate Muslims, right? Anyone heard about the moderate Muslims? This mythical creature, this fiction that resides with Bigfoot and a bearded unicorn. You guys have heard that, right? You can find them on your magic carpet if you go over an enclave, a no-go zone, which, by the way, is dominated by, quote, non-assimilationist Muslims who carry out as much of Sharia law as they can in America and Europe, quote, unquote. Thank you, Bobby Jindal of Louisiana, for that quote. See, there are some who want you to fear me simply because I'm an American who happens to be a practicing Muslim. Their rhetoric seeks to turn us, Muslims, your neighbors, your friends, your doctors, your taxi cab drivers, your tech support, your relatives, into perpetual suspects instead of what we really are, your partners, your neighbors, and your fellow Americans. Their extremist narrative only seeks to divide Americans among religious and ethnic lines. But apparently to some, Islamophobia is just fiction, a manufactured ruse used to silence free speech and dissent. It doesn't exist, like climate change. It's awesome. We can go home now. Easiest honorarium I've ever gotten in my life. Islamophobia, according to the facts, exists. It's real. It's pervasive. It's toxic. And now it's mainstream. Islamophobia is anti-Muslim bigotry. Don't let any verbal or pedantic or semantic gymnastics fool you otherwise, right? It's anti-Muslim bigotry. Homophobia, you want to break it down? Anti-LGBTX bigotry. Anti-Semitism, anti-Jewish bigotry. And it makes all of us, not just Muslims, all of us, including our troops and law enforcement, less safe and secure. And it's fundamentally anti-American. It's against our American... that's a conspiracy there to silence me. It's all right. It's all right. I'll run with it. I blame the Egyptians. I love fool. It's against our American heritage. It's against our values of pluralism and freedoms, and it's nothing new. Keep this in mind. You're Americans. It takes its DNA and its playbook directly from the hateful fear-mongering that was used in America against Jews, Catholics, and Japanese Americans. Same DNA. It divides the world into us versus them, and it paints an apocalyptic civilizational conflict. Islam is at war with the West, and the West is at war with Islam. But like Linda said, there's a significant cost to such inflammatory hate. Islamophobia overwhelmingly affects those who are innocent civilians, and it just doesn't affect Muslims. It affects those who appear Muslimy. For example, the first post 9/11 hate murder was of Balbir Singh, a Sikh American, whom the murderer chose because he was, quote, dark-skinned, bearded, and wore a turban, end quote. Ask yourself this, where will this lead us? How do we benefit from hysteria, fear, and scapegoating? What do these Islamophobes and anti-Muslim bigots inspire except division and hate? This is not about free speech. This isn't about a cartoon. This is not about satire. This is about extremism and hate, and it's going to take all of us to overcome it. Thank you.
Thank you, and when we air portions of this on the radio, only Wajahat will be broadcast in stereo. Faisal Saeed Al-Muhtar is our next speaker.
Hello, everyone. I come from a place in which getting stoned to me is different than New York. So I'm gonna excuse my lack of cultural knowledge, because where I come from, getting stoned, like here in New York, is totally awesome. I come here with a message, actually, from a mutual friend of me and Ayan Hirsi Ali, who could not make it today. It's from our friend Sam Harris. And I'm truly honored to kind of carry weight of all of these wonderful people, but even with all my disagreements with them. He says, I suppose I can only echo the thoughts of many in attendance here today. When the choice is between taking the side who offer peaceful speech, however offensive, and those who threaten violence in retaliation, there can be no choice at all. Please take a moment to appreciate how odious it is that a person who has suffered and accomplished so much and has had the courage to speak about her journey in the hopes of helping others cannot be with you today for the fear of being killed by theocrats. In New York City, of all places, there is only one religion on earth that currently treats its critics this way, that hounds and hunts them everywhere, issuing credible threats of murder. Hello? And yet, to merely observe the fact is now widely branded as a sign of bigotry. Those who speak of Islamophobia protect only theocrats and thugs. I lost, because this is very important, that never those whom they oppress, all of us, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, are now suffering because of their efforts. If you care about living in an open society where people are free to speak and write and believe whatever they please, don't be gulled into thinking that there is a trade-off between a freedom of speech and a freedom of religion. Nothing Ayan has ever said or could say has infringed any Muslim's right to practice his or her faith. Yet her right to speak to you today has been effectively canceled, as has been your right to hear what she has to say. Sam Harris. I come to you, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, or shall I say comrades, from a country that is ruined by Islamic extremism, where about a third of the country is controlled by the Islamic State, another third, is controlled by the sectarian Shia government, and you have Kurdistan. I was in a conversation last night, because I was like a very, they called me like last minute, you're going to be on the panel, and I was in a conversation last night with a friend of mine, Omar. He's in Baghdad. He's a secular activist who lost two of his family from Al-Qaeda, from Baghdad. And I told him, I'm in New York City, and you know what? I'm really afraid to be on this panel because I'm replacing somebody who got death threats all over. And he said, that's what he told me, which actually kind of made me tear a bit. He said, Faisal, if you are in the West and you think this way, what hope do I feel to tell, if I tell my neighbor that I'm a secularist, my head will be chopped off? That is in Baghdad. Just look at the security around here. Not far from where we are sitting right now, 3 miles away, I don't know if you're familiar with the Book of Mormon. Anyone is familiar with the Book of Mormon? Raise your hand. Great. So if you're familiar with the Book of Mormon, it makes fun of Mormonism, Mormons as well. It's a show on Broadway. And does it look at the security there? Or look at the security here. Can we one day have, if all religions and all ideas are equal at this moment, can we have a show, the Book of Islam, on Broadway? Okay? And if you think that, yes, if you think that this is possible without tens, if not hundreds of people getting killed here in New York City, then you're completely delusional or maybe take LSD. Thank you. So I want to make this point that it's very clear that there is a huge difference between criticism of Islam and anti-Muslim bigotry. Humans have rights. Cultures, ideologies, and religions don't have rights. They are ideas up to debates and discussion and criticism. And to stand against pre-medieval ideologies that thought that man, that the earth is a flat and women are properties and gay people should be stoned to death is the complete opposite of bigotry, is actually compassion and reason. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Faisal. By Sam Youssef.
Hi. First of all, I agree totally with Mr. Douglas Murray. I think we should all fear Islam. I mean, because, you know, according to him, Islam is an opportunist infection that is actually killing Europe, not extreme Islam, but Islam. He also goes and say, like, all Muslims are out there to either subjugate you or to convert you. So we're out there to get you, basically. They will also tell you that our major cities are being taken with Islamic majority. We should make things harder for Muslims across the board. So why don't we just, like, go to the next level, put us all in concentration camps and just throw us in the gas chambers? It's much easier this way. No Muslims, no Islamophobia. Let's get it over with. I mean, the thing is, it's very easy to go, yeah, there is, like, violent text in Islam. And, yeah, I can actually tell you more violent text from Islam. Like, for example, if a woman on her wedding night doesn't bleed, so she's not a virgin, she gets stoned. Oh, sorry, that's in the Bible. Oh, yes, that's in the First Testament. But the thing is, he will tell you, but we don't do this anymore. We don't follow that anymore. As if in the 1950s and 60s, if you see pictures from Cairo, Afghanistan, from Beirut, as if we are being ISIS all our lives, beheading people all the time. He doesn't tell you that what we're seeing now from this barbaric attacks from people in this religion or like belonging to that religion happened in the last 30, 40 years because they were empowered by billions of dollars for one of the most backwards countries in the world through its Wahhabist ideologies. They have put like money, they have put like power, political support. Now, I want to give the same power, political support to Westboro Baptist Church and KKK and let's see what they're going to do. You're going to find like more extreme people who are usually doing the same literal interpretation of the Bible. But he doesn't do that. I mean, it is a political game. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you know, maybe you don't. We didn't have Sharia law empowered that much in our constitution in Egypt, and Egypt until Anwar Sadat in 1980 put that in the constitution in order so he can pass another article where he can get unlimited presidential elections. Ghafar Numeri, who is the notorious dictator of Sudan, he put Sharia law in order because like his country was falling apart and he wanted like money from Saudi Arabia and that was the only way to actually keep himself into power. The same thing with Saddam Hussein at the end of his days. The same thing with like many. This is like a military thing that they used religion in order to control the people. This is a game that has been used by Christianity, Judaism, Muslims. And you know what? In Myanmar, you have peaceful Buddhists killing non-Buddhist people. Where the hell are the violent texts in Buddhism? You don't know. But the thing is, I really don't care about the religion. I know what, do whatever you want. I'm not an Islamic apologist. I care about the people. But because the thing is, when you hear over and over and over again, Islam is a religion of violence. Islam is a religion of violence. People will associate that with the evil that is Islam with the people who are Muslim. And then everybody will look to Muhammad and Aisha as a ticking bomb ready to explode in their face. Now, these remarks were all said before Charlie Hebdo and before ISIS and before everything. So maybe, I don't know, what came first. But here's the thing. In the Middle East, we have radical imams. I wish they were in hell. That they go and they curse Jews and Christians and Shia if they're Sunni and Sunni if they're Shia, and basically themselves. And they would say, and they, this is like considered hate speech. And Mr. Douglas Murray said they should be shut down. And I agree with him. They should, because this is hate speech. But he's doing the same. He's doing the same, but on bigger platforms. And he's affecting larger number of people. Now, is Islamophobia is a problem or not? I don't know. It's sitting right there. Thank you.
Thank you, Bassem and Asra Nomani.
Well, Bassem, you don't have to look that far down the road to find...
I love you.
Well, I wonder if you do, because you don't have to look that far down
but
the road.
I still love him. Lois is like Islamophobic. I love him.
That's great, because you're sitting next to an Islamophobe.
It's all right.
And I would like to say that, you know, we think that it's an issue about hate. We think it's an issue about discrimination. There's nobody on this panel that will support hate, that will support discrimination, or that will support racism. But this question of Islamophobia became very real to me when I was called an Islamophobe. I thought to myself, how is that possible? I love my mother, I love my father, I practice the faith that I am in, and I fight for it. And it is because, as a Muslim woman, as a feminist, I've dared to stand up on issues of extremism, issues that you would agree with. I've dared to stand up for the right of women to go into mosques. But as a result, what have I been called? A house Muslim, a house Negro, an Uncle Tom, an Auntie Tom, and a Zionist media whore. So as a journalist, I worked for 15 years at the Wall Street Journal, I asked myself, how did this happen? How did we get here? And I looked back into the history books. Everybody knows the War of 1967. It was a moment of great humiliation for the Arab states. In 1969, they created an organization called the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. It is today a mini United Nations, second only to the UN. And this body has brought into our world a strategic campaign in 2005 that said, we are going to combat Islamophobia in the world. And how do they define it? They don't define it as beautifully as you do, against hate, because we are all against hate. They define it also as any conversation about Islam as a political movement or a military movement. So what does that mean? We can't talk about the Muslim Brotherhood, which you have so eloquently done and so courageously done. We can't talk against extremism, as you have eloquently done and as you have eloquently done. I mean, we are all just one word away from being called Islamophobes, according to this political movement. And what have we then created in our modern day? We have created an honor brigade. This is a network of people, loosely connected bloggers, anonymous sometimes, many times people who write with their names. And what do? They silence debate. We could see it right here. What was the civil conversation that we had when these two men spoke? Were they interrupted? They were. Because there is this cultural issue in which we think that because you offend the other, because you challenge another person's idea of, quote, true Islam, as the Organization of Islamic Cooperation defines it, you have defamed a faith. And I agree, I have never met Islam. I don't know how I offend Islam when I try to speak my truth, and I believe that we all must be allowed to do so. I want you to know that I had to take my own act of courage. Last week, when BAM put on their Facebook page this invitation, I saw that my first death threat, the man who first posted it in the year 2005 with a lovely, very subtle moniker of Death to Asra, had RSVP'd that he would be attending. The lights are too bright for me to look out there clearly to see if he is sitting among you, but this is the reality of what we face today. The fact that Ayan Hirsi Ali did not make it, the fact that NYPD police are sitting outside, the fact that my parents, who are in their 80s and 70s, came because my son, who is 12 years old, is also here to witness. My mother has planned in her own mind that if somebody was to arrive as a gunman into this audience, she would throw her body on top of my son, and then my father would throw his body on top of his. That should not be happening for anybody because they are Muslim at all. They should never feel threat, racism, or discrimination. And it should not happen for anybody who speaks their mind about issues that matter to them in Islam. So I invite all of you to really reach into your hearts and ask yourselves whether this idea of free speech is important to you. 10 years ago, this was a struggle for the soul of Islam. Today, this is a struggle for the soul of our country, and it's a struggle for the soul of our world. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for your opening statements. I think we can agree, after hearing all of you, that no one wants discrimination, no one wants terrorism, and no one wants to silence debate, at least on this panel. So how do we proceed? How do we proceed to come to the place that everybody needs to be in so that all of those problems are addressed without breaking down an enmity among people who basically agree what's important in the world? I don't think you guys are going to need me very much tonight, but Linda, do you want to pick up from where Asra left off?
I don't even know where to start, Brian. I think what's really interesting about this conversation is on September 3rd of 2014, I was attacked on the streets of Brooklyn by a man who said that he wanted to cut my effing head off so my people can see what it feels like. That's a real attack on the streets of New York City. When I have to deal with women who are living amongst us in a place like New York City and they fear to walk down the street because they wear hijab, that's what we're talking about here. And people on the stage will say, well, how do I contribute to that conversation? There are people here that we can quote for days on who have called things like Islam like the death cult. I mean, Ms. Hirsi Ali has many quotes that my brothers here will share. I don't like to get into personal narratives, but what people don't understand is that the impact that Islamophobia has and the way people use their personal stories. I will never take away Ayan Hirsi Ali's story. I will never take away Asra's story. But why is it that my story isn't the story of Islam? I am a feminist too, and I am a woman and a very proud feminist. And I love my religion, and I believe that my religion empowers me to be the person that I am. I am allowed to walk into any mosque in New York City. I have never been shunned from any mosque in New York City. I have presented to rooms full of men in a place like New York City, actually across the country. So this mixing of what a lot of folks do is they mix cultural customs with Islam, and it's false. So when we start talking about things like female genital mutilation, it is not an Islamic practice. So why do we allow folks to continue to feed us misinformation? So what I call upon people is respect the stories of the individuals, but never make the stories of the individuals the story of an entire 1.6 billion faith community. Asra's story is important to Asra, and that is her experience, and I'm not going to take it. But Asra's story is not my story. So I will not allow a few cherry-picked Muslims or people who are not Muslim anymore tell you what Islam is and what I am as a Muslim or what my faith represents for me. But, and that's the problem that I have when we talk about Islam and who's allowed to say what Islam is and who's the credible person that is able to talk about Islam. And just one last point really quick, Brian. I'm not interested up here to have an ideological, theological discussion or pull out quotes from the Quran, because every single social issue that we have and every problem that we have and every ill that we have could be found in other faiths. What I care about is Muslims and Muslim communities and how they're being treated and vilified in this country, and how we as Americans cannot stand for the vilification and dehumanization of any faith group, including Muslims, because we saw what happened or the potential of what could happen in a country like the United States of America that continues to practice racism against black people, anyone who's not white, and remembering that Islamophobia is also translated into government policies. This is not just about ordinary Americans, what you think of me. There are policies that are targeted against my community, including NYPD unwarranted surveillance, for the very simple fact that we are Muslim and we follow the Muslim faith.
Asra, keep the dialogue going. Go ahead.
I think think it's really important to recognize that this is not a competition of identities. Ultimately, our entire goal, to answer your question, is to live in peaceful coexistence. I think ultimately, everybody's stories comes from a place of pain. To me, fear, this idea of phobias, this idea of people even fearing the West, Muslims fearing walking on the streets, Americans that may have fear of Muslims, this all comes from pain. And to me, the deepest place that we can actually find healing and actual movement is to acknowledge truths within our communities. And so we have to talk about the faith. We have to talk about issues of ideology, and we have to talk about the interpretations. I have with me my Quran imported from Saudi Arabia. And what do I have post-noted here? I have post-noted every interpretation of faith that is used for misogyny, for violence against Jews, for violence against Christians. This is a reality that we have to deal with. I'm not willing to go into mosques and sit in the back places. Somebody else might be willing to do so. But this is these are legitimate issues for which we don't have to have a competition of ideas, but in fact have some kind of conversation so that we can find some common ground where we can live in peaceful coexistence.
Basim?
Well, the thing is, I mean, I don't know why is there some sort of a notion that we are not having this kind of discussion in our own country. It's difficult. I mean, of course it's difficult. I mean, no one here in this panel or here will tell you, yes, we can have this kind of discussion in Egypt. Yeah, we are living in a shithole, all right? Okay, we're living the whole, like, region is cursed right now. So it's like I'm not really going to debate this because our whole region is being run down by incompetent, corrupt, extreme governments. This is what we're living. We are actually sharing this pain, and we want to change that. And within that, there has been many reformers who've spoken up. Some of them were hurt. Some of them are continuing to do that. So the idea is like, oh, we should not speak about Islamophobe without actually speaking. This is already, the other conversation is already happening, and it's happening in here in California, here in the United States. Basically, in the Middle East, there are some people who are penalized for this. There are people that were evicted from the country. And you know what? Not by Islamic extremists, by military governments. Because military will use Islam as a tool at any time. And now, I'm here not defending Islam. Does Islam has like violent interpretation? Yes. So is every religion. It is when a certain group of people take hold of executing or putting some certain order prevail where you can see that, because it's the same Quran that people are reading in the 50s and the 60s. Why weren't we beheading people at that time? It is the same thing. We were not cherry-picking at that time. Again, it is a very backward movement that was empowered by money, by politics, by militarization, and this is why it is prevailing. And we are fighting that in our own countries. As a matter of fact, this, the first ever article I ever written in a newspaper in Egypt, it was the benefits of being an atheist. And I was defending people to actually show their faith or non-faith. And I had the threats, and people said you're an infidel, and people said you're anti-Islam. I can share my stories too, right, but I don't let that.
Where are you going to be living now?
Well, you know what? Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
That's my point.
You know, but we're fighting it. Yeah, who's that? So because I can't live in my country, I said that, so we should actually have like a broad brush and having old, it's like the problem with Muslims. I mean, I really don't care about like saying that a certain religion is extremism or not. Say whatever you want. But in the process of doing that, you are actually affecting the communities and the Muslims who are paying the price.
I think
you have to be very careful.
I think you're hearing something that we're not saying.
No, I'm hearing quite well.
I'm going to let other people speak, but the truth is that what you are doing is you are collectivizing statements that are being very direct. And so you are saying that words are coming out of people's mouth that have a collective
They do.
And I refuse to accept that because ultimately I am not saying that.
But the thing is, like, what you said, I agree with. I love what you said.
So the bottom line is it's a political movement where national...
Political.
Right.
And it's political.
What is the Organization of Islamic Cooperation? It's the government.
Exactly. It's the government, corrupt government that I hope they go to hell.
I'm so glad we agree.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I mean, nobody will hear disagree.
All right. On that point of common ground, let's bring in some of the other speakers. Douglas?
Could I just pick up? Linda said something very interesting there, which I think hits on important point. She said the NYPD targets Muslims because they're Muslims. That's a lie, isn't it?
No,
they don't. The NYPD is not, as I understand it, I'm a visitor to your city, so I'll allow you some leeway on this one. But my understanding would be the NYPD is simply not just an organization that just delights in targeting Muslims and only targets Muslims and targets Muslims because they're Muslims. A much more honest interpretation of this is that there is indeed a security threat in this city, as in many other cities around the world. The major part of that security threat, as your government and my government acknowledges, comes at the moment from Islamic fundamentalism. It has come from other things in the past, and it will again, but that's the main threat at the moment. And that may be the reason why the NYPD takes a particular note of activities in mosques and elsewhere. Now, you may not like the way they do it, but it doesn't come from nowhere. So when Linda says they do it because we're Muslims, that has two effects. Firstly, as I say, it's not true. Secondly, if you're a non-Muslim listening to that, and you're reading through your newspapers, and you're reading of thwarted terror attacks and real efforts to commit terror in cities like this, and you see a prominent liberal feminist Muslim like Linda saying we're being targeted because we're Muslims, you think, well, that's not true, is it? And then you wonder what on earth she's covering for. What on earth is behind that? I don't think she's covering for anything, but it's the sort of thing that raises questions in people's minds. Why would a moderate not say, yes, we have a problem from within our community and we would like to deal with it, and we will do everything we can with cooperation from the police and everyone else to deal with it. Right. And then everyone else says, well, there's a moderate, there's a progressive thing, there is no need to be suspicious of Muslims. Let me pick up another couple of points very quickly. This question of what is Islam? Islam is a shape-shifting ideology in this example. No one can say what Islam is or isn't. It's a very complex thing. None of us are going to be able to sum it up on this stage. But the interesting thing about it is that you can, to a great extent, call it whatever you want. Now, Bassem pretends that the problem from within Islamic fundamentalism is a very recent thing. It's come about in recent decades. It's petrodollars. It is, apart from anything else, therefore, our fault. How easy.
No,
the problem from
fault.
This is that it ignores, again, and it exacerbates the problem for non-Muslims. It ignores the fact of what non-Muslims can see, which is that this is clearly not a problem that has only arisen since the 1970s. It is a problem. All faiths have problems.
Yes.
All of us agree on
that. Yes, thank you.
All faiths have problems, and all still have to wrestle with the hard texts in their religion.
Yes.
But we would acknowledge, would we not, that some of these problems are there from the start and have to be dealt
with. And nobody denies
this. And it doesn't help.
Nobody
it doesn't help.
This. I
it
didn't
doesn't
deny
help
this.
If you pretend this is a post-1970s problem.
Nobody denied this. Nobody can pretend that it's post-1970s.
That's what
I said what we're having
as.
Right now was, but there was like a brief moment in history of modernization. I mean, we had our dark ages, very long dark ages, like all the other religions, but there was like this glimmer of light in the middle, and that is was crushed by what is happening recently. There was hope. There were people like Nasr Hamad Abu Zayd, like Farag Fouda, like Mohammed Sayed Ashmawi, like Ali Abdel Reza. All of these people were on the lead of Hasib Kiram. All of these people were in the lead in modernizing Islam and rejecting that kind of extremism, and they were crushed by who? By the military, corrupt government using religion. Now, the thing is, I'm going to give you a question to the audience here. Now, I agree with Douglas. You know, he says that it doesn't come from nothing. There is actually like horrific stuff, so we have to be careful from a certain group of people because their faith or their ideology can develop into something dangerous. But here's the point. I'll give you an example. What if a certain person was threatened by Muslims over and over and over again, had an attempted murder that he was saved from, then his business was bombed, then all the media, the Islamic media, kind of like pushed and said like, and they insinuated hate against him, and then a few years later, he is killed, and after he is killed, the Islamic media ridicules him. Wouldn't that be horrible? I mean, that would actually be one of those painful stories that we share here to prove how horrible Muslim societies are and how in denial they are, and they don't like solving their own problem. Now, there's a guy called George Tiller. He had an abortion clinic. 1986, a right-wing terrorist called Shelley Shannon tried to assassinate him. She failed. 1993, they bombed their clinic. Then O'Reilly in Fox News kept saying the narrative, Tiller, the baby killer. Tiller, the baby killer. Tiller, the baby killer. 2009, he was assassinated by another extreme Christian group. After he died, Ann Coulter went on Bill O'Reilly's show and said, well, I don't consider this a murder. I think he died in his 203rd trimester. Now, why are these people not in jail? Why are the right Christian movements are not being profiled like the Muslims? But, I mean, please, some justice here.
All right.
Douglas, go ahead.
But that's, first of all, I don't feel responsible for anything Ann Coulter says. And
exactly.
I think she's very barely responsible for it herself.
Sam, let him go.
But let's at least be honest from this. Citizens of New York City are not at police and the security service of this country do not currently believe that the citizens of New York City and people like yourself are at significant danger that the number one terrorist threat to you is from people who are against abortion. That's just not the terrorist threat. That's not the security threat. Now, were it the security threat, then you would have to look at Bill O'Reilly's Facebook page or cross-reference everything Ann Coulter had ever written and try to work out who was saying. But that's not the situation right now. And what I'm just trying to get is an honest discussion which starts from the premise that there is a real problem, there is a real security threat. Islamic communities have an enormous, unparalleled, important part to play in stopping that. But if you're going to get the trust of the rest of society, you have to acknowledge it's there instead of saying that the secondary thing is the problem we all have to tackle.
Right.
That the Islamophobia is the problem.
Linda, then Wajahat.
You know, I have to have someone from London tell me about NYPD and what the NYPD is doing.
Well,
so
apparently you do.
NYPD, NYPD, and this is a hit at the systemic racism of the New York police. They are not on the individual officer, so let's get that straight. It is found that the NYPD had to shut down the demographics unit, which was a unit that was used to map Muslim communities, 250 mosques, cafes across the city, sent informants on whitewater rafting trips with Muslim Student Association, tried to infiltrate the board of directors of social service agencies, okay, in this country. We have no problem with law enforcement doing their job and following credible leads. But if we are the partners, if we have a role to play, then stop treating an entire faith community as suspect and start treating us like
clients. They're clearly not.
So don't tell me about police. When you stigmatize an entire community, we saw this in other communities, including black communities, where the NYPD will stop and frisk 695,000 young people of color, and not over 90% of them, not even an arrest or a summons, that is called racial profiling.
It's called religious profile.
So don't tell me about being under unwarranted surveillance. We are talking from a place of experience, and we have multiple lawsuits with the New York Police Department and conversations about changing fundamental policies that look at religion as a factor for profiling people and suspecting them to be terrorists. So let's get that straight.
If your number one security threat comes from that community, would you not think it made sense?
It is not the number one security threat. Through the FBI, the number one security threat is separatist group.
So the question to the question.
Militias.
All right, yeah. So let's be clear here. I support the NYPD, okay? I am not going to jump onto this bandwagon of bashing the police and deciding that this question of Islamophobia is then a justification for a negative and hostile attitude toward the police. You're laughing and smirking because, unfortunately, that is exactly the danger and the dynamic that has resulted from this entire decade-long movement of Islamophobia. We have created, and you're sighing, because we have created...
Well, what is it, Gabby?
We have created...
And I am drinking also.
We have created... We have, because of this, we have created a hostile movement inside of our communities about the FBI, about the police, and about America. If you look at any of these networks that try to then charge Islamophobia against people, they are also targeting the entire identity of America. And this is a serious issue. This is not something that is just a joke. I mean, this is ultimately a serious issue about how we're going to define this country.
Linda, would you address directly what Douglas said twice, which is that the problem is secondary to the real problem of Islamist extremism, and so the NYPD has reason to look in more corners of Muslim communities in New York than other communities.
Brian, the NYPD has a job to do, and the job is to follow credible leads. Their job is not to look for a needle in a haystack. When you have credible leads, suspicion of criminal activity or terrorism activity, by all means, go into the mosque, go into the cafe, do what you got to do. But painting a broad brush of every Muslim, student associations, 250 mosques, this is not how you find terrorists. Tom Galati, chief of the NYPD in 2012, said in a deposition, he said, this demographics unit created zero people, zippo, none, no terrorism leads. So if your law enforcement needs to be effective, not ineffective, and when we there's an assumption that we don't care about the security of our communities. Any one of us who lives in New York could have been in the World Trade Center the day that those towers went down. I could have been there. My mother could have been there. So this assumption that Muslims don't care about security. I want NYPD to do their job. I want NYPD to solve crime. I want them to go where the crimes are. Don't just paint us with a whole broad brush. That's all I'm saying.
Let me, you know, I think in their usual context, I don't think Wajahat or Faisal usually get labeled the introverts.
No.
But Wajahat, go ahead.
Wajahat is the pretty boy.
This was interesting. This is kind of interesting right now. So let's talk about national security. I think everyone can agree that we want to be safe and secure. We want to keep our communities secure. We want to make the world secure. Let's talk about national security. Douglas mentioned what's the number one threat that we're facing here in America. Let's tackle it head on. No BS, no politically correct language. You know what the number one domestic terror threat is, according to the FBI? Sovereign Citizens Group. Radical right-wing anti-government group is the number one domestic terror threat in America right now. So I've heard some... Let's talk... Forget about if it's right or wrong. Let's talk about solutions.
The FBI are wrong.
Let's talk about some solutions. The solutions I've heard today and applauded is surveillance, right? And mass profiling. So, let's have some mass surveillance of right-wing white men from the South. Let's have some profiling of white men. I would like Doug Dynasty to be profiled, because quite literally, who looks like Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi? Doug Dynasty. Just saying. Point I'm trying to say, I'm making a, you know, it's silly. What we're applauding racial profiling, all right? We're applauding surveillance. You said profile me, Asra. It was an essay you wrote, which I disagree with. But let's see if it's actually effective. Let's suppose you say, you know what? National security threat. We want to keep our communities safe. We'd rather feel safe than be free. Let's trade away some civil liberties. Let's go after those minorities. I don't care. You know, let's take a big old net just to feel safe. Let's see if it actually works. Racial profiling. Does it work? Mass profiling of Muslims or mass profiling of Americans based on religion or ethnicity. According to the 9/11 Commission report, it's ineffective and counterproductive. Let's go to surveillance, mass surveillance, 2011. Associated Press, Matt Apuzzo and Adam Goldman came out with a piece. NYPD did mass surveillance of Muslim communities, Muslim students, based on ethnicity, based on last names, based on where they eat food. All right? Halal carts. And it was crazy because Muslims also love burritos. So, like, who knows? It's going crazy. Everything's being surveilled. You know what the second piece is they found out? The NYPD, after spending so much resources, so much money, so much time, so much man and woman power, found out that they could not find any actionable threats. So all of those resources that should have been used intelligently, in a focused manner, intelligence doing intelligent work, can you imagine that, were actually wasted, number one. And number two, let's look at an example. These two men who did the shooting attack in Garland, Texas, one of them, the FBI has been following for a while. He was on the FBI radar, and still, this person was able to get guns and commit this act because when you do widespread surveillance, it is counterproductive, it's ineffective, it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. What it does, though, it increases the trust deficit between law enforcement and American Muslim communities, according to the facts. I love some facts. American Muslim communities are actually very proactive in working with law enforcement. 40% of violent extremist plots were thwarted by whom? Muslim American tips. Mm. American Muslims, especially after 9/11, they're doing something. American Muslims after 9/11, more than any other group, work with law enforcement. That's also a fact. New American Foundation came up with that study. What we're seeing right now, also, we want to talk about, let's go foreign. Who is fighting and dying right now? Who is fighting against ISIS and Al-Qaeda? Who is fighting and dying in Pakistan? Muslims. 50,000 people in Pakistan have died on the war on terror. About 10,000 of them who are in law enforcement. There's so many civilians. So the people who are dying are Muslims. The people who are fighting are Muslims. And finally, let me put this. I'm an American. My parents are living in California right now. They do not have specialized knowledge on how to fight ISIS. You know, my mom is trying to figure out how to make the most bomb biryani of all time, right? All I'm saying is this. The methods that you guys are proposing are not working, number one. They're ineffective, number two. Counterterrorism and law enforcement specialists, experts who have followed this, said this does not make our country safe. It actually leads into this extremist narrative. I'll get you there. Just give me... I've been waiting, man. 20 seconds, I'll be done.
That's a big mistake.
Extremist narrative is this. The West is at war with Islam. Islam is at war with the West. Do you know what the number one recruitment and number one propaganda of violent extremists like Al-Qaeda and ISIS is? The West is at war with Islam. They point to the Ground Zero Mosque protest. The West is at war with Islam. When Pastor Jones, the gentleman with the handlebar mustache from Florida, inspired by that Pam Geller event, it was manufactured, threatened to burn the Quran. He actually did burn the Quran. What happened in 2011? The Afghan Taliban actually retaliated 2 weeks afterwards and attacked a UN compound saying that we're avenging this act. Extremism begets extremism. The solutions that you guys are coming up with to attack a real problem that we all agree with will only make our world more unsafe. Think about that.
Let me just get that clear.
I want Faisal to get a say because he hasn't yet in the follow-up. I just want to ask one question, which is, so
you're equating burning the Quran with the riots that happened in Afghanistan. That's the moral equivalence that you just presented.
No. You're fueling the narrative of the extremists.
No, you just married a moral
Petraeus.
Wajahad, you can reply to what she said.
General Petraeus, a guy who knows something about counterterrorism. At that time, before he was known for, you know, some scandals and some adultery, in 2010, top commander working in Afghanistan sends an email to the Associated Press during the time of the Ground Zero Mosque controversy, right? During the time you guys were here, you saw it, manufactured controversy. I hope we can talk about it afterwards. Said the following. He's doing some important things. Takes a time out. Sends an email to AP. This type of inflammatory rhetoric and this type of divisive actions actually threaten our national security, and I fear that they will threaten the security of our troops. So we should have some moderation.
And why?
Pastor Jones burns the Quran.
Let's just be clear.
And what happens?
Why did General Petraeus have to fear the safety of our troops? Because we have a culture within our Muslim community that will not allow debate. We don't allow it here. We snicker, we laugh, and we make a
joke about it.
And I just want to say, that, you know, that's essentially what happens. That's why General Petraeus and other leaders in this country have to have political correctness trump rational thinking.
I think he was thinking about national security.
I think it's time to bring in the Iraqi representative on the panel.
Exactly. I would like to start with something that, it's kind of interesting that I wasn't expecting when I came to America that I would hear so much nonsense about being talked about what the real problem is. First of all, who's fighting ISIS are people as extreme as ISIS, funded by Iran to fight. So they're not really the moderates that you're trying to portray as, the liberals versus the conservatives.
That's not true.
What I see about the real discussion is really focused mostly about one, maybe 2% of the U.S. population compared to the Muslim world, which is the peaceful majority that they talk about. So let's really talk about this peaceful majority that we're going to hear. There are 13 countries that execute people for being non-religious and atheist. Let's make a guess. Which are the religion? Are they Mormons? Maybe not. All of them, I can name them here. Afghanistan, Malaysia, Maldives, Mauritania, Nigeria, Pakistan, which has nuclear weapons, Iran, which is probably going to get the nuclear weapons, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, the motherlode of bad ideas, Somalia, Sudan, United Arab Emirates, and Yemen, and you can add Gaza also to that section. And this is so-called the peaceful majority that people are going to say. So what is, I think it's very like very interesting here in America, is that if somebody is not ISIS, somehow he's a moderate. That's like a very false confusion, ladies and gentlemen. It's a very false confusion. Is that, you know who else not ISIS? Al-Qaeda is not ISIS. And there is, so if we're going to look, and I'm going to cite here Pew Research, the North Carolina Chapel Hill, the research on elections within Islamic majority countries, and you have the Gallup poll about what the so-called peaceful majority actually believe in. So there is this confusion that's being mostly created, is that there is like these ISIS folks who are like just bunch of psychopaths, leave aside that some of them have degrees from MIT and they have agency to get a degree at MIT, but they don't have an agency to join Al-Qaeda or ISIS. They're just bunch of psychopaths, and there's no study, actually, no clinical psychology study that they're actually psychopaths, because the moment you're going to discuss that ideas and beliefs have consequences. This is something that is what is really create this huge confusion around the topic of Islam is that this so-called anti-Islamophobia, folks, is that Islam is a religion of peace, and that leads people who are very confused from the non-Muslim side, is that you look at the Quran. I was raised Muslim. My parents are Muslim. I read the Quran, and I read the Bible. I read the Torah. There are books which are filled with violence, and what's happening with these so-called moderate Muslims, what they do is other than actually, and here's what the difference between the, you mentioned religions, they all have the bad stuff and stuff, is that what happens with the Christians and Jews is that they look at these verses and they condemn them. While what happens within the Muslim world and within the moderate Muslims is they actually try to find a way of like postmodernist language. No, actually, like when they said like adulterers should be stoned, actually that adulterers should have marijuana. They don't really mean that they should get stoned. And you see, like this moderate Muslim of try to, other than say, you know what, this is a problem within our faith. There are verses that truly about violence. And by the way, the leader of ISIS has a PhD in Islamic studies. So we probably have the most credentials around from the panel over here, but because nobody of us had... I can cite statistics on and on about the treatment of women. The worst countries to be a woman are Muslim-majority countries. The worst 10. And that's the Huffington Post. I'm quoting the most liberal white guilt media you can ever find.
But Faisal, if I may follow up, what are you saying? Are you saying what I'm suggesting, Islam is a radical religion and the problem really is Islam and moderate Muslims don't actually exist?
What's happening is that Islam is a spectrum, okay? There is no one Islam. There is no one true Islam.
And this is exactly the opposite of what we were just saying.
No. Let me finish. And the majority of the Muslim world follow a much conservative interpretation than we think that they follow. So we have this concept is that there is ISIS and there is liberals. It's not really true. The majority of Muslims hold the views. There's a Human Rights Watch made a very good graphic about the difference between Saudi Arabia and ISIS. And they found the commonalities are very in common. Okay? Iran hangs gays and etc. The beliefs that ISIS holds, when you're going to ask them a question, and you can go to Pew Research on Islam and Public Policy, that many Muslims in Egypt, 60% of Egyptians believe that apostates should be put to death. I can cite statistics about Pakistan. Indonesia, female genital mutilation is 97%. And many people say, oh, it's all an African issue.
In Indonesia.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And therefore, for you as the leader of a global secular humanist movement, is the path to peace to discredit the religion?
No. The path to peace is to acknowledge the bad interpretation of Islam, and we should support the reformers. The reformers, not the moderates, the reformers who acknowledge that there is a problem within the religion, and let them reform their faith and have a much mature 21st century aligned Islam that is not being followed right now by the majority, and we have to empower, and what the Western world and the free world can, we should do, is empower these reformers, not stand against them.
Are the reformers moderate, or are they radical? There's a difference
between a reformer and a moderate. The reformer is somebody who acknowledges that there are problems within the doctrine, and try to take this, just like with the Christians and with the Christian Reformation, which kind of went very violent. And the moderate is the one who does not acknowledge. So they say, you know what? Islam supports gay marriage. Islam supports women's rights, Muslim feminism. And at the same time, they say that there is nothing wrong with Islam. and they look at ISIS. And I look at a lot of the videos of ISIS and things like that. And they constantly quote, and they have an interpretation that is, I'm not going to say it is the true interpretation, because that's not such a thing as a true interpretation.
These are not moderates, they are assholes.
Huh?
I mean, these are assholes, not even moderates. I mean, we don't, I mean, do you actually
ISIS are not moderates, I agree.
No. The people that you're talking about, like quoting, like giving some sort of a justification of what ISIS does. I mean, I don't know, like, why are you keeping bringing on Saudi Arabia? Do you find anybody here who support Saudi Arabia politics?
No.
I mean,
are you
seeing anybody here who's actually acknowledging that these 10 countries who treat women badly, I mean, do you think that we are actually condoning that?
No.
Do you think that we as moderates, we have this kind of discussions, that maybe there's a problem with the root, that maybe there's a problem with the real interpretation, that maybe there is not one Islam? I mean, why are you assuming that? You don't know what kind of conversation that's happening in the East Coast and many of the West Coast mosques, and they are being crushed by the amount of money that being spent by the Wahhabis there, and they are trying to fight back. Why are you assuming that we're not having this kind of discussion?
Can I just add something?
The fact is, none of he comes like, oh, Islam is a religion of peace. I really don't care about proving that.
Yeah, but there are people who do.
I care about quotes like this.
Everyone does.
I care about quotes like this. Now, here's the thing. The problem is with putting all of us in one bracket. If you're not ISIS or Al-Qaeda, you're a moderate who is basically a potential ISIS or Al-Qaeda, and you're part of the problem. When someone like Ayaan Hirsi Ali says a quote like, for over a billion Muslims worldwide, including the many peaceful Muslims, you and I know the Shahada, La ilaha illa Muhammad Rasulullah, is a political rallying cry and mission statement achievable only through violent jihad. I mean, is this the way to actually bring in people on your side? You're alienating these people. As a matter of fact, you're pushing them away.
One brief response, and then
is that one of the main important things about statistics is that you're not really generalizing. The thing about statistics is to avoid generalizing. Is to cite.
Well, I heard why jihad statistics and kick ass.
So what's happening is that this narrative has been pushed. You look at what ISIS is doing, and you look at. People say, no, it has nothing to do with Islam. This is all from Mein Kampf. This is bullshit. What ISIS is following, what ISIS is...
If
moderate Muslims, I'm not,
I don't know who
I'm
you're
not talking
quoting.
About you. If
you
moderate Muslims, if moderate
Facebook,
Muslims
I mean,
are not going to call ISIS not Islamic, they should call Saudi Arabia, Pakistan, and Iran,
and
all of these 13 countries non-Islamic.
Okay.
Ryan, can I just add something?
Asra, then Linda.
Okay. So let's be really clear. We agreed that the political movements are part of the problem.
Yeah, huge.
And we agreed that Saudi Arabia is part of the problem.
And its culture, as you
said. Okay. And where is the Islamophobia Observatory based? Do you know?
No.
Have you ever heard of it?
No.
They do a little checklist. I think you've heard about it, Wajahat, because you're good friends, I think, with the Islamophobia Observatory chief. Where is it based? You know.
Please tell me.
I don't know who are these people even.
They're based in Jeddah. Where is Jeddah?
So?
Where is Jeddah? Jeddah is in Saudi Arabia.
So what? Do you see anybody condoning this kind of center you just made up?
Yes.
I mean, I really don't care.
You know why?
I really don't care.
You may
the
not...
The Center for Moderate Islam Basim, is in Mecca. Okay,
Basim, can
good
I,
for them. I don't
I just,
really care.
Can I just make a note that you are not the Islam... You are not the movement alone. The movement the movement to try to tarnish people as Islamophobes is beyond
I'm
you.
I'm not tarnishing anybody.
Exactly. So I'm not associating you with it.
You
and my
My point is, I asked you a question, and my point is that this Islamophobia movement to try to deem people by these names is based in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. What interest do they have to keep us silent on the debate about Islam?
They are not part of this panel, and they are not part of this conversation.
Well, you know
and
what?
None of us
what?
Actually has found what he's saying.
Excuse me, Bassem, can you please not interrupt me for a second? I want to just say,
my relationship to Saudi Arabia is the same relationship you have with North
Great.
Korea.
Okay.
I really don't care about Saudi Arabia.
What's their impact?
But you know what? This is a really serious issue to me, because if you want to make jokes about it, that's your job, and you do
I'm
it really well.
About Saudi Arabia.
You do it really well.
I get paid to be
but to me, it's a really serious issue, because ultimately, if the government of Saudi Arabia has exported to our world these kind of Qurans that tell us that the Jews and the Christians are not to be our friends, and that it's okay to beat your wife, then this is part of the problem. And if they are the hub and they are the headquarters for a movement that wants to tarnish the reformers,
and
as
why
you
is
are talking,
their allies. I mean,
stop
because they are like
her.
Turn a blind
Great.
Eye to oil. I mean,
so you can
take this with the policies.
So, yes. You can.
Asra, how much?
I mean, Bassem, if you
I mean, seriously,
can,
how much, I'll be the happiest person on earth if America had change of heart towards it. But like,
I would
I
love
don't know,
that.
That's my problem.
But
my,
you know what?
I mean, we're trying to fight, but we are outnumbered.
Let's not try
we
to deflect. Okay.
You know, this is the problem that we're freezing.
Denial, deflection is very typical when you don't want to deal with
I'm not
the very
denying.
Clear. Yes, you are. You're just deflecting. And this is a typical place to try to deflect it back to U.S. foreign policy, which is a clear and a rational place to have critical debate. But at the end of the day, we in our Muslim community have to take responsibility for what we've created. Right. And we have created a campaign to try to demonize and to try to smear the reformers so that they cannot be effective. Right. And what's the ultimate objective? To make them not credible. And thus, Wajahat, you, for example, in one of your blogs decided to call Ayan, who you've now quoted, I don't know if you would agree with this, a prostitute. In the infotainment industry. Like, who does that? Like, what does it mean to slut shame someone then? Mm. You quote Ayan Hirsi Ali there. Do you think she deserves to die because of
no,
what
of
you
course
read?
Not.
Exactly.
Of
does
course
she deserve,
nobody, I don't
does,
deserve
does she
I don't
deserve
that.
Does she deserve to be slut shamed?
No.
And why would you participate in that? But that's ultimately the dynamic that we end up
who
enduring.
Who participates in that? So, here? Somebody here participates
so,
in that, did
no.
you say?
So Wajahat will have to explain.
So Wajahat can speak for himself. So Asra actually opened the conversation for me. Thank you very much. You know, this deflection is really, let's talk about the real issues. I like to look at things holistically, and Faisal forgot to tell you after he said a third of his country is taken over by ISIS and a third by some sectarian groups and the other third by I don't know who. He forgot to tell you that the United States government killed 650,000 Iraquis and went
false.
Into an unjust
false.
War.
False. Anyway, many of them are sectarian warfare.
Anyway,
many
no,
of them are sectarian
so that's,
warfare.
So that's
Sunnis
fine.
Versus Shias. Don't blame America
again,
for killing Muslim killing
anyway,
Muslims.
And when we talk about when people want to talk about ISIS, for example, they forget to tell you that the majority of the people killed by groups like ISIS are actually Muslim themselves. So they forget to tell you that too. Yeah. And I really have a hard time understanding how we are going to combat extremism and address this issue, these groups like ISIS and Al-Qaeda, without really looking at the root problems. ISIS didn't just fall from the sky one day. They didn't just wake up one morning and say, today I'm going to be an ISIS fighter. That's just not what happened. We as a government supported Osama bin Laden, and then we find ourselves decades later fighting against Osama bin Laden. So what I'm trying to say is this. I will not give the responsibility of the murderous and the barbaric actions of ISIS to other people and include them in their own responsibility for their work. But we cannot act as if U.S. foreign policy, right, doesn't matter or it's not part of the conversation. So I just have this cherry pick of conversations for me doesn't personally make sense at all. And if we don't start having these holistic conversations, well, we don't, and most majority of Americans, by the way, are anti-war, peace-loving people, okay? Many of us in this country were against the war in Iraq. But to say that we have, as Americans, no role in what's happening in the Middle East right now, I don't know. And then to also disregard the millions of Muslims who went out into the streets and stood up against snipers for freedom and democracy, for me, is also disingenuous. There are people in every corner of this world who appreciate free speech,
who appreciate freedom of religion, freedom of expression, women's rights, to act like we're some Western exceptionalism, that's the only thing that we appreciate as Westerners. People love that all over the world. So we need to get off our high horses as people in the, quote, West, and understand there are people just like us living on the other side of the world all that right. deserve to be treated with dignity and respect.
Douglas, hang on. We're going to... I think the point at which we're going to bring in audience questions, I can't quite say deep breath or... exhale.
Yeah,
can I?
But we are going to take some questions, and I'm sure you'll get a chance to continue where you wanted to pick up from what Linda said. But we don't have all night, and I do want to give people a chance. We do have a planned first questioner down in the front row, and that is Aladdin Ulla, who is an actor, born and raised New Yorker, been on HBO, Comedy Central, MTV, PBS. Seen him in the movie, perhaps, She Just Sings the Blues or American Daisy. Aladdin, where are you?
Yeah, but I do think we missed a very important, like, that
well, you will, we will, I'm sure you can jump in where you're going to be. We could go on all night, and we're not going to solve it tonight, but I want to give people a chance before we get kicked out of here.
Yeah, we can help. Say,
you guys covered a lot. I'm going to be brief because everyone wants to talk. But one of the things that hasn't really been addressed, and Linda has been eloquent in describing, you know, basically how mass media has contributed to the hysteria of, I don't want to get into semantics, Islamophobia, I can't even spell it, but anti-Muslim, whatever, right? So, like, after 9/11, just if we can go back, after 9/11, there was all this mass hysteria of, like, the Muslim is the boogeyman. So there's, like, everything was, like, the Muslim is the boogeyman. So what that did here in New York, white folks were losing their mind. So, like, you know, I recall the week of 9/11, I was doing the show with Dave Chappelle at the Cellar down in the Village. So I'm taking this is a true story, I can't make this up. So I'm on the subway, like, half asleep, and this white lady is saying, get up, I'm an American, go back to your country. So I woke up, and I'm like, lady, I'm from 112th Street, what are you talking about? So she's like, why don't you Afghanis go back to Pakistan? And I was like, I'm not even Afghani. She's like, you Iraqis, go back to your country. So there were a few people there, and I love an audience. I said, okay, lady, pick another country. By the time she got to, like, the 12th country, Pakistan, I was like, lady, I'm from 112th Street. So she was naming all the countries that she heard on TV. So, like, you know, I agree with Balsam. I think what Balsam does is probably more important than any journalist, because we have to expose the bullshit and the so the reality is that it's really difficult because, like, a lot of first-generation Americans who are, like, in my case, like, agnostic atheists, we question our disbelief. Like, we don't really, we're not devout or nothing, but once... Like, that happened, like, I remember that, like, everyone has amnesia, but I remember the week after 9/11 very well. My mom was calling me saying, like, there are people threatening to jump us on 96th Street. Not the South, it's not Arizona, 96th Street and 3rd Avenue where the mosque is. So, like, I'm thinking, well, what's going on? So when I went to pick up my mom, there's people screaming, go back to your country. And, of course, my mother's like, I live across the street. What are you talking about? So you also had another thing on the west side. You have the Afghan kebabs, which are restaurants. There were people with picket signs going, go back to your country. What they didn't know that the chef is from Bangladesh. So it's like, I feel like, is there a way where there's people who are not devout like us to acknowledge, and this is a question I wanted to ask Douglas and also Linda, that we can acknowledge that, like, extremism is wrong. We know these guys are crazy. As Balsam said, it's politically corrupt. But can we also acknowledge that American imperialism has radicalized a lot of these radical Muslims? And that, can we just call... Why does it have to pick two sides? Right. Can we just pick...
The question... Let me give... He asked Douglas, and I want to give Douglas the next say, because he hasn't gotten in a while either.
Look, as an observer of your country and a visitor to your country, may I just observe... This masochism, which you enjoy in America, is ugly. This idea that you blame yourselves for everything. Guess what? The world doesn't rely on America to create everything, including the world's problems. Some of the world's problems come without you. And Islamic fundamentalism existed centuries before this great nation was founded. It It has its origins for hundreds of years before that. If you think this is, I mean, look, let's not get it wrong. American foreign policy actions, like all other countries' foreign policy actions, have the chance to go wrong, have the chances to make problems worse. I'm not denying that. But you are seriously off the mark if you think that's where it starts. Let's just look at ISIS for a moment. Linda mentioned ISIS and said, let me please finish my point. You had quite a good go. Linda said ISIS didn't just drop out of the sky. True. What you went on to say was not true. ISIS didn't just drop out of the sky. Look at anything ISIS say and anything ISIS do. ISIS do not define Islam. Let's get that clear. They have the worst possible interpretation of Islam, the worst possible interpretation of Islam for Muslims, and the worst possible interpretation of Islam for non-Muslims. But they have a plausible interpretation of the religion. This is a serious problem beyond any of us in this hall to deal with. It is a problem that Al-Azhar in Cairo is trying to deal with. It is a problem that every single... It is a Everything that's serious is funny to you.
No, because it's not true.
Every single expert in Islamic jurisprudence, every single theologian, and I would argue most Muslims around the world are wrestling with this at the moment. And most non-Muslims are as well, because they hear on the one hand, and by the way, your idea that, as it were, post 9/11, all the white guys all lost their minds. Look, straight after 9/11, President Bush, I'm sure not somebody everyone in this hall supports, President Bush goes straight to the Islamic Center in Washington and says Islam is a religion of peace, this has nothing to do with this great religion. At least give people credit for things they say when they say them.
We actually do.
And let's just remember one follow-on from this. We all have access to books now. We all have access to the internet, Muslims and non-Muslims. And I'll finish on this thought for me. One of the things that is going on at the moment is a very, very fast realization of problems that do exist within Islam as they do within other religions. But when Christianity went through this problem in the early 19th century was the last time, when higher criticism from Germany started to wash through the Christian world with effects that we're still living with. When that happened, people had to travel for days to get to Göttingen in order to find out what was happening. They had to spend months learning a language. This stuff took 5 decades to go from Germany to Britain. These days, it goes around the world in a nanosecond. People can read the Quran for themselves. They can read ISIS statements. They can watch the videos. They can read what is coming around the world. And people realize there's a problem. All I am asking is that if we're going to get through this, yes, we say don't lump all Muslims in together. Don't say ISIS speaks for Muslims. It's vulgar, it's not true, it's obviously a lie. But also, if you are a Muslim in this, say, yeah, we have a problem. We have certain problems. We're trying to deal with them. We're doing what we can. It would do an immense amount to build trust.
Briefly, Bassem, because it seems that Douglas got a laugh out of the Egyptian comedian when he said that the government of Egypt is fighting Muslim
terrorists. I didn't
mean
any disrespect, but I mean, I'm sorry, what you're saying is a little bit misinformed. As a matter of fact, Al-Azhar is a tool for extremism is a tool for extremism right now. So Al-Azhar is not trying to do anything positive about Islam in Egypt. As a matter of fact, we pay $10 billion Egyptian pounds from our tax money to the government in order to empower Azhar. Now, the thing is, Azhar has been used by the military government in order to stop any kind of what you're trying to say. You're telling us as if there's no tribe. All the tribes to say that there is a problem, that there is, this interpretation has something extremely wrong with it. There is something with the history, there's something with the traditions. But you know who always stop against this? It's Al-Azhar. And who empowers that?
Sure,
who arrests people in the streets? In the military.
You don't need to tell me that. What was the response of Al-Azhar when a Jordanian pilot was burned alive? Al-Azhar said it was anti-Islamic because of the defiling a body. What was Al-Azhar's reference about the punishment for this? Crucifixion.
Yeah,
I'm not holding them up as moderates, okay? I'm really not.
The thing is, nobody's here is defending either the government or its religious tools. We have this problem. We're trying to get this conversation going. People are getting arrested by the military government again because they are adopting a conservative religious problem. It is political more than anything. All religions have problems, all right? And all of them could be used as a tool. But the thing is, we're trying to have this kind of a conversation, and the thing is, what you're doing,
by saying that this is not going anywhere, or this is like your the problem is the Muslim community, is not really empowering.
He never said that.
We have about 10 minutes left.
He never said that.
In the event, let's go to somebody else in the audience. Somebody on this side. Okay, sir, over there. Do we have an usher with a microphone over there? Sorry, the guy in the second row.
Wait, hold.
Yeah.
Sorry.
On 9/11. I was one of the two people from out of 3,000 in my company who went and gave blood before the towers has fallen. Towers had fallen. When we come back, fifth floor, we go up to our office. The entire parking lot was empty. Everybody was sent home. This gentleman, both of us gave blood, lying on the stretcher at Red Cross in West Orange. He turns towards me as we step out of the elevator on the fifth floor. He goes, "Wasim, is it an Islamic holiday?" I had never discussed religion in my life, you know, in that company for 3 years before. I didn't have a beard. I never talked about Allah or Allahu Akbar or anything that could. And he was the guy sitting right next in the next cube, you know. So what I'm trying to say is it's the ignorance of this level that has been fed by the media in this country. It should not be denied. In this country, whose job it is, constitutionally guaranteed, that it should inform the public of what is true. What is true? Whatever it is, you know, wherever the truth leads us, let's go there, you know. And on the other side, on the other hand, like Basim and others have pointed out, there are huge problems with the Muslim world. It's not Islam. It's a Muslim culture in whatever region, and it has evolved over or kind of remained whatever in those kind of regions, you know, for whatever multiple factors, you know, and also made complex by colonialism and self-examination or lack of it, you know, for multiple factors that has kind of created this huge mix, which is actually a huge problem more for Muslims than for others. But unfortunately, the kind of discussion and discourse other than this we had today, a very enlightened one, is kind of mostly to create hysteria, right.
Okay.
And for his use of by politicians of his
we,
kind.
We
but
your
the question
point,
is,
I
the question
give
is,
else
what
a
what
chance.
Anyone would like to
I, as a journalist, add to that. As a journalist, I would like to say that I think that the Muslim community has been part of the problem, and the Muslim organizations that have declared in press release after press release exactly the statement that you just said, that it has nothing to do with Islam. That is part of the problem. What these men are arguing is, and what we have accepted, what you have accepted, and what everybody on this panel has accepted, is that there are serious issues within Islam, and we have to name it to tame it. We have to own it, and we are not. We have not been doing that, and this whole phenomena of branding anybody who has a civil conversation about Islam and the extremist issue and Islamophobe only serves to silence it and make people less knowledgeable. It doesn't serve Muslim communities and Muslims well if we just try to perpetuate this idea that there is a true image of Islam and all of the extremists are aberrations that have nothing to do with reality.
Brian, yeah. All I'm asking for is fairness. Okay, right now, while you're sitting in this room, there are Christian militias in the Central African Republic who are massacring Muslims, right? There are extremist Buddhists in Burma right now massacring Muslims, right? I'm not asking for any Christian in this room to stand up and condemn Christian militias on behalf of the Christian faith. I don't want anyone to ask me to do that either. So what the problem is that's happening is we have a different obsession with focusing on Islam as a faith and focusing on what the Muslim community's responsibility is to other Muslims who are saying they're Muslims that are doing things in the name of Islam, but we would never ask anybody else to do that. So that's the problem. But one last point I want to make is the media, absolutely. The minute a Muslim does something, we are not allowed to be crazy. We are not allowed to have psychological problems. We are terrorists. I don't care what the act that they did was. So let's just call it what it is. We're not saying let's not have constructive conversations, but I want you to call on other people to let's talk about, you know, let some of the quote Islamophobes, well, we don't agree on that term, to let's join together. Let's do those same people who vilify Muslims, right? Are they also saying Black Lives Matter?
They are.
Just because you don't hear it
doesn't mean that.
Yeah. And the same could be said about moderate Muslims.
And we're so vocal about the anti-Muslims, but not about the.
I mean, justice issues. So your idea of targeting the Buddhists and the Christians, we ask everybody to take responsibility in their communities, and so the churches are taking responsibility. The Dalai Lama is taking responsibility. We expect Muslims to take responsibility.
So many. Yes. More yes, audience no, questions. That you, woman over here is next.
I see.
This is going to be our last audience question, and then we'll get some closing thoughts.
I just wanted to say I find this conversation very interesting, and I'm happy it is taking place. And three very quick remarks. I mean, I do think there is a bias in the Western world looking at Islamic extremism or terrorism, so there is a very narrow focus. I mean, people who are not allowed to speak or bomb threats, like it was an event about misogyny in computer games, it couldn't happen because there were bomb threats. Or in Europe, like the most people incarcerated for terrorism or terrorism attempts are nationalists coming from the Basque country. It's not Islamist. So, I mean, there is a certain bias there when we look at statistics. And then secondly, I think fear is not a good advisor, right? If we all think, well, we're afraid that something could happen, that, you know, there's a gunman in the room, well, then we get emotional about it. So we're biased again because we kind of blow the issue up and blow the danger up, and we fear really Islam and not Islamism anymore. I think that is very dangerous, clouds our thinking, to act on those emotions. And then second, also, I really want to say, Khan, that the political context always needs to be taken into place. It's not that Mormonism is so different from Islam, and that's not the reason why there is Islamic extremism, right? It's a political context. It's position of power. It's world politics. It's alienation of minorities in Europe, for example. So to look at it as just a cultural phenomenon, I think it's completely wrong. Mm. And then thirdly, when we talk about... Okay, I'm wrapping up. And then just looking at a matter of fact, is Islamophobia really helping anybody, right? Like the things that Pamela Geller does. Are they helping? Is that getting us anywhere, right?
All right.
So that is my question.
Thank you. So, let's get a very brief thought, and we'll just come straight down the panel, starting with Douglas. Is it that everybody agrees that discrimination is bad and exists and should be fought? Extremism is bad, and especially violent extremism, and needs to be fought, and it's a question of which thing stirs your passions more? Is that what we've been doing here all night, Douglas?
I wasn't terribly clear on the question. I wasn't clear on your summary either, I must say. But let me just say, look, to some extent, the gentleman here epitomized the problem. You said, sir, I'm not being mean, but this is what you said. It's not Islam, it's Muslim culture.
Right.
Where does the Muslim culture come from? Islam.
Thank you.
This is quite an important point. And let's just run that through with other... Let's say, look, as I say... Islam, in the way it's being described at the moment, is a shapeshifter. It can mean everything and anything anyone here wants to say. Let's take three not insignificant schools of Islamic thought. Let's just take, we've talked about Al-Azhar, let's also take Saudi Arabia, and let's take Iran.
But wait, so these you are...
Very, 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 very quickly. These are all major institutions and have great power and run whole states, and as we see, pump money into countries like this to pervert Islam in countries like this. The reason why we haven't talked about Christian militia and so forth is that the Pope and the Archbishop of Canterbury really aren't wrestling with the problem of whether or not you should massacre people. They're really not wrestling with that theological question at the moment. And so that's the problem. The problem is at that top level as well as everything else.
But then you are, by your own words, anti-Islam?
No. I'm saying that there is a problem which every other religion has had to face up to, which Islam is facing up to at the moment, and it's very, very painful. And most people don't want to face up to it, including non-Muslims. Muslims and non-Muslims don't want to face up to it. Non-Muslims say religion of peace, Muslims say religion of peace, and more people can see that's not enough.
Faisal.
Yeah, I mean, thank you. Like, we're talking about the bias here. Actually, I think what is the bias is that about your question is that it is very American-centered. Mm. The world does not revolve around the United States. And the Muslims, that's number one, and Muslims, the 1.5 billion Muslims live across a lot of parts of the world, and which are actually ignored by the American discussion. So when you're talking about these are really, I mean, we're really discussing a very important, what I'm seeing is that there is a denial within the moderates about the idea that there are other interpretations which are legitimate that can be violent. I mean, I still remember in school, on Tuesday, my Islamic history teacher said we should kill all the Jews. On Thursday, he said we should love everybody regardless of their religion. Then I told him, tell me, should I kill the Jews or not? Like, because that is the really the issue of religion, is that it's really contradictory and on spaces. And talking about, and you see that a lot of the effect, we're talking about ideologies and their consequences. And there is a reason, put back the Mormonism, is the issue that these religions, these two major religions, have been reformed, that the majority of the Christians and the Jews do not follow the verse that tells you should stone women to death for not being a virgin. On the other side, in the Muslim world, these verses are taken literally. The problem with fundamentalist Islam are the fundamentals of Islam. And we cannot ignore the idea that the fundamentals lead to fundamental. The problem is not extremism. Right. It's fundamentalism of people following things fundamentally.
Down the panel, 1 minute each to wrap up. Bajahat.
That was a fun love fest. Look, there are many problems in today's world. There's hate, there's violent extremism, there's racism, there's intolerance, there's bigotry, there's climate change, and yes, even Islamophobia. It's tempting to tap out and throw in the towel. There's just too many wounds that need to be healed. But do not fear. And I'm going to echo the wise words of one of the great Sufi sheikhs of all time, Sheikh Yoda. Fear is the path to the dark side. Fear leads to anger. Anger leads to hate. Hate leads to suffering. So have hope.
That's great, man.
Thank you. If anything you got today was that Yoda impression.
We so should really hope, end right there.
Have hope in people, and have hope in people's innate goodness. For every anti-Muslim bigot, there are 10 neighbors here in America, in Brooklyn, standing up against hatred, working in tandem with members of another faith to make sure another mosque is not protested against, to make sure that Muslims are not denied their space in court, to make sure that maybe a Muslim one day could be president. That's happening.
I thought that already happened.
But I also... Well, it happened twice, right. Allegedly. I'm just kidding. He's not Muslim. If he's a Muslim, worst Muslim president of all time. Eats bacon.
That's right.
Moving forward, it's time to gain knowledge, empower ourselves with understanding and love. We need to reach out our hands across the aisle and grab it in good faith and have hope there will be a friend's hand that will grab it. And we have seen that we have many friends. People who realize the American dream needs to become a reality, and these hate mongers are poisoning the communal well.
All right.
Fraying our shared values, we need to inoculate ourselves against hate, bigotry, fear, for the sake of our shared values and diversity. I want to mention this. If you replace many of the memes, the anti-Muslim memes, Sharia is a threat to America, they're a fifth column, where's the moderate, will they ever assimilate, they're a demographic threat, a demographic time bomb, as Douglas Murray has called them before, replace Muslim with Jew or Catholic. Replace Islam with Catholicism or Judaism and go back and read 20th century American history. It's a remake. This is a remake. It looks like it's new.
And
this is a remake.
Need to jump
the
in.
Characters right
keep
now.
It going.
I'm finishing right now. The characters right now, the antagonist of this global narrative extremism is Muslims, but back in the day it was Jews, Catholics, Japanese Americans, gays, and lesbians. The people who fan this hate always end up as the villains in our children's history books. They always end up as the villains in our children's history books.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Linda, you're going to quote from... He did Star Wars. Are you going to quote from E.T.?
No. I'm actually going to be really serious right now, and I want to make my closing in honor of Abdus Samad Sheikh, a Somali 15-year-old boy who was shot in Kansas City by an Islamophobe, in honor of Diyat, Yusuf, and Razan, who were shot by an anti-theist, a radical anti-theist, in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. We just learned from their autopsies that Razan and Yusuf, the sisters, were shot with a gun straight to their heads, execution style. So the reason why I closed in honor of them is because Islamophobia is real. And we should all together be standing and saying, never another Diyat or Yusuf or Razan or Abdus Samad Sheikh in this country. And we should all be standing together moving forward and saying that we will not allow hate against any community in this country, and to understand that while we can be proud Americans and want a better country for ourselves, to remember that racism in this country was way before ISIS came along and has continued to permeate from one group to the next, and not stopping in between, because as we know, we've been vilifying black communities since the founding of this country, but to remember that we need to stand together and say hate is not allowed in our country. We'll not vilify an entire faith community in this country because we are American and because we are better.
Sir.
This tragedy that happened in North Carolina was a very serious one, and it was a very dramatic one. The autopsy was a very horrifying one, and the same horror that those who feel that this was a target against Islam feel about Islamophobia is the same kind of frustration that so many Americans and so many people in the world feel about Muslims when they don't acknowledge the fact that we have an extremism problem. The jury is still out on whether that murder and those murders were a hate crime, but yet the verdict is in. And this is exactly what has happened in so many instances. When there was a murder in Southern California, those on the panel here were quick to call it a hate crime, and they were quick to call it Islamophobia. But what it actually was a man from Iraq who murdered his own wife in an honor killing. And so this cover of Islamophobia has been used to protect the, quote, honor of our Muslim community. We are a culture that is based very much on honor and shame. We don't want to lose face. We'll do anything many times to save face, as you demonstrated earlier. We will continually deflect. We will also demonize others, but we won't own our own problems. And that is what will serve Muslims most. That is what will serve Islam the best, is if we can avoid this kind of deflection and denial and actually talk honestly about the problems that exist within our community instead of always blaming others and playing the victim. We have to own our problems. And from there, there's another Sufi poet who says, wounds are where the light enters you. And I believe if we open our wounds to healing, then we can allow the light to enter us on both sides of the equation. And that is where I believe this kind of conversation can leave us in all of our hearts to a place of healing.
Hassan, one minute.
All right, well, again, I'm just going to repeat myself. The problem here that you're trying to paint a picture where we have some sort of a denial problem. None of the people here said Islam is a religion of peace the whole night. None of us actually acknowledged that.
Linda said it many times.
I said Islam is a religion of justice. So
not really. Watch MSNBC.
Well, listen.
Let Bassem get his last
tonight,
word.
We were all discussing the people. None of us here deny the fact that we need reform. None of us here deny the fact that our governments are actually the. I'm not the kind of person who goes like, oh yes, America did that. I'm first to blame our own governments and even our own culture to do it. We have a struggle in our own cultures. What happened in the last 4 years and with the emergence of extreme Islamist move and ISIS is a blessing in disguise. Because now, although the Arab Spring, the revolution has been defeated, we have a revolution of another kind, a revolution of the mind. People are questioning the things that have been taught in schools about the Islamic State, about the glory of the Islamic Khalifa. People are saying, is this the Islamic Khalifa? I don't want it. I don't want to be part of it. Let's then go to the origins. This kind of a conversation, it's happening. It's new, but it's happening. After 60 years of, again, using Islam as a tool in the hand of the military. When someone takes you to jail, he's a police officer or an army officer. He is not a sheikh or a scholar, except, of course, Saudi Arabia, which please stop referring to it because no one here is supporting. So the question is, how can we help? How can we help each other? Does it help when you say that all Muslims should be denied immigration into Europe? It doesn't. Does it help when you say that the shahada is some sort of a decree to announce jihad? It doesn't. Does it help when you paint like with a broad brush about like all Muslims? It doesn't. We are having this problem. I mean, I don't think that Christian reformations came from outside the religion. It came from inside, and it took them a very long time. Yes, we are in our adolescence years. And compared to, yes, and you know, we have like acne, we're a little bit, you know, we have this kind of problem, we are a little bit crazy, but we are trying to deal with that. And it really doesn't help when you use this kind of inflammatory kind of speech, because you're alienating everybody, because now the extremists are like, see, I told you the West hates you, why don't you come to my side? This kind of vacuum creates more extremism. Nasser Hamza Abu Zayd, he was thrown out of the country because he was one of the people who said we should look to some sort of like a non-literal interpretation of Islam. And the government who threw him out was the military government, was the secular military government. Our problem in the Muslim world is basically political. If you give empowerment to certain interpretation of a religion, it will prevail. If you give empowerment to a certain interpretation, to an extreme Judaism or Christianity, like what happened like a few hundred years ago, it will prevail. I mean, I'm not here to discuss is Islam the problem or not. I'm here to discuss the things that got us to that point, which is not just religion. Religion is part of it, is a platform, you use it, it's according to how you use it.
Right.
All right? All right? I wish that I live in a secular Arab and Muslim world where everybody can voice their opinion. I wish that, and many like me wish that, but they are silenced by the oppressive regimes that are either monarchy or military using Islam as a tool. And I wish we get rid of them. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, please thank our panel. And thank you very much for coming.